Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. 8 minutes and 30 seconds ago, I met our speaker. So I don't know him personally, but his name is Mike, and I believe he's an alcoholic, and that means I think I probably know him pretty well anyway. So here, I give you Mike.
Hey everybody, my name is Sean Spicer, and I'm very happy to take this Emmy that Stephen Colbert gave me last night. I got to tell you, that was one of the funniest things I ever saw in my life. If we can't laugh at ourselves, who can we laugh at? Actually, my name is Mike Boatwright, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 2nd, 1990, and for that I'm eternally grateful. And I'm a member of the Mount Vernon group of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my home group. And I've celebrated a lot of birthdays there, and for that I'm also very grateful. I want to start off tonight by taking just a moment. This is kind of unusual, and I certainly had not planned my talk to start this way, but I wanted to take just a minute to remember a young person named Scout Schultz. Scout was born in a kind of an unusual manner. Scout was born with two sets of genitalia, male and female. And at a very early age, his parents and the doctors had to make the decision. And they made the decision that the Scout was always troubled by the fact that he didn't get to make that decision. They, because Scout always called themselves they. They, them, referred to themselves as gender neutral. Which is all right by me, and that's not what this program's about. But what I could relate to was how Scout grew up and spent his whole life feeling different than everybody else. And Scout was shot by the Georgia Tech police Saturday night in an armed confrontation. He was wielding a knife, and he wanted them to shoot him. I keep saying him, because that's not Scout's nature. Scout wanted to be called them. And the police kept saying, calm down, and tried to back him down. And finally, they just charged at the police with the knife, and they had to shoot him. And that was the only thing they had to do. And I share this story for a number of reasons, one of which is that for the past couple of 3 years now, I've been working with a group of Georgia Tech students in an organization called Drama Tech. They're theater kids. They're very sensitive people, kind of like I was. They have a whole lot of fun, and it's good, clean fun. They put on theater. They're the oldest theater company in Atlanta, and they put on some really professional programs. And they don't run around crazy fraternity stuff that I did when I was at Georgia Tech 35 years ago. I was a member of the drinking fraternity on campus. I remember that I could down a 10-ounce beer in 3 seconds and not leave a ring on the table, and I was real proud of it. I was on the beer drinking team, and I was, that was where I belonged. I had arrived when I arrived at Georgia Tech. Because like Scout, I had started off my life somewhere, I don't know what it is about age 8, but I think it's somewhere around age 8, I somehow realized that I was different than everybody else. And part of it was physical, because I had a couple of physical ailments when I was 10 that kept me out of gym class and some other stuff. And I became a nerdy kid. And that was before it was cool to be a nerdy kid, you know. We were kind of put down by you know. And in fact, I always grew up feeling for the underdog. I felt for I was the one who wanted to kick sand and the big bruiser guy at the beach, you know, that was always making fun of the nerdy kid without a suntan. And when I found booze, what it really did was alcohol made me feel like others looked. When I heard that, I could so relate. Alcohol made life bearable. And when I was a kid, my parents used to do a lot of entertaining, had a lot of parties and stuff. And my parents used to throw these parties, and they thought it was kind of cute that Mike was mixing the daiquiris. And what they didn't know was every daiquiri had a little wit for Mike. And of course, it got bigger until, you know, when I finally in high school, I was a secretive drinker. I mean, even I didn't party with everybody. I mean, I would just sit at home on Saturday nights and sneak a couple of beers out of the refrigerator, or put water back in the booze bottles, my parents' booze. Somehow they never seemed to notice, and I know my dad was a very angry man because he would have really not liked me to take his bourbon. And funny, I became a bourbon man too. So Evan Williams ultimately beat me into a sense of reasonableness. I actually threw my first public drunk right after I graduated from high school. A buddy and I decided to go camping down at High Falls State Park, down near Macon. You know, some of y'all know that. Some of y'all may have been drunk down there before. And we drank a, between the two of us, we had an 8-pack of Miller Ponies. And then we decided we needed more. We put Annie Green Springs on top of that. That is a lethal combination. And so it was also the first time that I threw up in public, which I was not that much of a puker, but I blacked out I blacked out a lot. I was very much a blackout drinker. I always heard that alcohol caused it killed blood, brain cells. And so I always thought that made perfect sense, and that's why I couldn't remember what happened the night before, is because I killed a lot of brain cells. And I today have come to realize that probably also there's something buried in there about the shame of how I was acting and who I was, and you know, and that whole shaming cycle of look what you did again, you know, one more time, and all that crazy stuff. But it worked for a while when I was at school, and I was actually quite active socially when I was on campus, even though I was very much a scared little boy. I was in a fraternity, like I said, and we were the drinking fraternity on campus. We had a lot of parties, and they used to throw these mock riots at me because of my somewhat at times antisocial behavior. I have a T-shirt from Rock Eagle that says "Does not drink well with others." I didn't fit well with others. I didn't drink well with others, but I thought I did. And finally, you know, it quit working to a point where in October of 1980, I had convinced my dad to sell me this wreck of a Fiat 850 Spider that he had, and I was big man on campus with this Fiat Spider. But if you didn't know, Fiat is, I think, Italian for puts hallucinogens in baby's milk. For people growing up to be automobile engineers, because they're pieces of junk cars. And I used to have to carry a toolbox around the car to keep it on the road. And one night, I'm driving home from a fraternity, driving a couple of girls back to Piedmont Hospital. Back then, we had a nursing school at Piedmont, and we imported girls. There weren't that many girls at Georgia Tech when I was there. And so we import girls, and so we're bringing back home. They had a 2 o'clock curfew, and it had been a rainy night. And I remember coming down Collier Road, And one of the girls said, "I think you need to slow down." I was like, "Nah, this is my favorite curve." As I start to do 360s on that big curve just before you get to the creek, and I plowed the back end of the car into the creek, or the wall of the bridge over the creek. Now, mind you, that wall is 4 feet back from the curb, which is a full 18 inches off the street. And I think it's been since rebuilt. But there, for years, there was this 4-inch square of green paint where I put the back end of the car under that wall. And a good alcoholic that I was, well, the first thing I tried to do is I tried to push it off to make it go. But I had busted the A-frame and the suspension. It wasn't going anywhere. And I remember when this big old City of Atlanta cop, I mean, he must have been about this tall. And he said to me, "I don't know why I'm not running you in for DUI." And I was like, "Oh, no, officer." And he ultimately gave me a ticket for failure to maintain control of my vehicle, which he pointed out to me that I was pointed northwest on East West Road, and I didn't have insurance because the car wasn't insurable, and he let me go. He let my fraternity brothers take me home, and of course that was in 1980. They don't do that anymore. I don't know if they had dragged me into jail that night, maybe my story would be a little bit different. I don't know. I might not have gotten ahead. I'm convinced that it took every drop of alcohol that I drank to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and has taken me every day sober since to be who I am today. And I don't think a drop was wasted. In fact, I don't think anything is wasted in God's beautiful economy. And so There you have it. You know, that's when the fun drinking stopped. It really didn't. It never really worked after that. Although I kept trying to capture that camaraderie, that sense of friendship that I thought I had. But I did a crazy thing. I got up the next morning, and mind you, I didn't have that much sleep. And I went to church. Now I went. There's a church across the street from the Varsity, and I grew up in as a lifelong Episcopalian. And so I dragged myself up to church because I knew something was wrong. And for some reason, I felt very, very penitent, shall we say. And actually, it was really kind of cool. They welcomed me with loving arms. And it wasn't long after that I really started getting active in that church. And I tell you this, not because, and with singleness of purpose, I wouldn't, and our traditions, I wouldn't ordinarily share that, except for the fact that I got very, very sick in the Episcopal Church. I met my now ex-wife there. I was impressed because she got tipsy on half a Miller Pony on the day that on her birthday, and I just it was so incomprehensible to me. It was so intriguing, and then later on I got involved in a number of things. That I did a considerable amount of study of religion and theology and all that stuff, and all the whole time I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And you know, Bill talks about in the book that there are all kinds and sorts and conditions of our backgrounds and where people that ordinarily might not mix. And I was one of those people that went to church every Sunday morning with a bad hangover and a bad sense of shame, you know, every Sunday. And it just got worse and worse and worse. My wife and I got married. We graduated from Georgia Tech and got married the next day. I don't recommend that to anybody, especially since we almost got divorced before we got married, because my fraternity brothers dragged me out to a bachelor party and I came home stinking of cheap perfume and booze. And she didn't like that very much. Almost nearly killed me, as she had right to do. But my parents did not come to either. In fact, they had pretty much. I had a rocky relationship with my dad, but basically, at the same time that I was going through getting ready to get married and graduate from college, his mom passed away, and it hit him hard. And he didn't know how to deal with a son that was feeling his independence and wanting to strike out in the world on his own. And basically, Dad gave him a kiss goodbye, and that was really tough. Dad and I didn't have a whole lot of relationship together, but it really hit me. And I think that was a lot of my drinking, was that anger that I felt. I grew up, like I said, I grew up with a sense of being different. And I was just mad at everybody. I think some of it I may have inherited physically. There may be some genetic basis to it. My dad had some psychotic problems. Don't know the extent of them. Those medical records are long gone. But I was very, very angry. And a very angry, angry young man. And in April, let me back up. In early 88, I had gone on a business trip. It was either before, actually it was just after. So April of 88, my dad, suddenly I got a call from my mom one night. I was drunk as could be. At about 9 o'clock at night, she said, "You better get out." They lived in Houston at the time. She said, "You better get out here. Your dad's just had a heart attack." And I was not in any shape to get on an airplane right then. In fact, I don't know that there was a flight that night. The next day I got on the first flight I could. I'm really still shaken from being drunk that night. And I landed at Houston Intercontinental Airport about the same time Dad died. And I raced to the hospital. They said, "Well, you can go in and see your dad." And I wish I hadn't, because I went in and there was this man who had had 9 heart attacks in the span of 12 hours. And They basically couldn't save him, and he had tubes hanging out, and you know the whole mess that happens when something like that happens. And I mean that vision still haunts me today. Thinking that's not how I want to remember my dad. We had kind of come to some agreement. We were speaking with each other. We were having a relationship again. And suddenly he died. And I went back to Mom's house a few hours later, and I got a call from my wife to tell me that she was pregnant. And wow, I mean, even though he wasn't the best role model in the world, suddenly the only person that I had as a father was gone, and I had no clue what to do. But at that point, I had kind of figured out that alcohol would take care of my problem. And while I was trying to sort stuff out, I basically started hitting the bottle, and I pretty much just obliterated myself. And I call that my slide, 18-month slide into Alcoholics Anonymous. A few months later, I remember that I went in on a business trip to Singapore, 2 weeks in Singapore. And the only friend I had, the only person in the world that I could connect to at Singapore, was the guy that sold me a $55 bottle of Maker's Mark every night at the PX next to my hotel. And that was the only friend I had. You know, and whenever I hear people talk about the loneliness of the alcoholic in his cups, I think about that being, you know, literally the other side of the planet, 13 time zones away, and the only solution was to drink. And it wasn't long after that the wheels started coming off. And, I mean, really coming off. My daughter was born, and I remember as my wife was about to have my daughter, I managed to pull things together a little bit. And I had actually only had a couple of maintenance beers the night she went into labor. And so I was pretty much present for my daughter's birth, as present as a man can be in our kind of state, in our cups. But then after that, there was very, very little left. And I've got my dates and times mixed up here, but the point is that I was not a very present father for my daughter for those first couple of years of her life. And when right before she was turning two, my ex had found some empties that I had stashed. She thought I wasn't drinking, which is a pretty accomplished fact because she was a sniffer, and I had her fooled for a good long while. But she found the bottles, thought I had quit drinking, and basically the point I found out was I couldn't quit for 6 weeks. At that point, and then I realized I couldn't quit for a couple of days. And this had been Thanksgiving weekend. And on that Thanksgiving, I knew I was going to have a 4-day holiday, and I was going to try to clean up my act a little bit, because literally the wheels were coming off. Work was falling apart. Home was falling apart. I was falling apart. And so I can't remember if I drank on Thanksgiving Day or not, but it was horrible, horrible, horrible. And so the very next morning, I suggested early in the morning to my wife, hey, I think you need to take our daughter, Travis, for a walk, because I needed a drink real bad. And the next, literally 48 hours later, at that point, when I realized that, I was like, God, please help me. And it was less than 48 hours later that she found these bottles that I had left in some drunken stupor some other time. And I had taken my daughter to the zoo, and when we had come home from the zoo, she was sitting there with a couple of friends, and she said two things that I've never acknowledged to her face that were the most honest things I ever heard from her or me, which was that she said I was either a hopeless alcoholic or a pathological liar. She was right on both accounts. And the good news is that was my sobriety date. And it's also the separation date. It's on the court records in Superior Court of Cobb County, and I hope that that's always stays there as the case of Boatwright v. Boatwright. But a couple of days later, very next day, I dragged myself, my butt up to the mall, and back then, some of y'all may remember B. Dalton Booksellers, and I went in and I was looking for something. It was a crummy day. And for some reason, I just didn't drink, and I was looking for something to tell me what was going on. And I saw this book, and it was a blue book. I think we've seen it around this room a little bit. Some of y'all may have one. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was shrink-wrapped, and it had that word on the front, alcoholic. And I wasn't ready to admit that yet. But sitting right next to it was a book titled I'll Quit Tomorrow by Dr. Vernon Johnson. Dr. Vernon Johnson was one of the early movers and shakers in the 28-day treatment program stuff that was going on in the 70s and 80s. And basically, as I read this book and I started realizing what was going on, he was telling my story, and I couldn't put it down. And he was talking about me, the alcoholic. And basically, he said, only alcoholics I've ever known are those who worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the SOB didn't put them in the book. I was like ready for any solution right then and there. And no, they weren't in the book. But a little bit later, my sister called. Now, I have two sisters. My youngest sister is a struggling artist in Ohio. And her form of the family disease was, Dr. Paul would have called it, Al-Anonism. She's an Al-Anon. And her form of the family disease was falling in love with alcoholics. So she was familiar with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she suggested to me, when she called up because she hadn't heard from us in a while, and I told her, I said, well, things aren't going so good. Linda's left, and I think I'm an alcoholic. And she said, oh, well, have you thought about going to an AA meeting? And I was like, no, I hadn't. Now, the funny thing was that same day, by the way, that I talked about getting sick in the church, and I had stood that morning for the vestry, which is the elders of the church at my church. I stood for election that morning, and by the grace of God, I was not elected because I was in no shape to do it. And by that night, I was suddenly taking my last drink of alcohol at a Hooters, and I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't stay sober. And that's a pretty pitiful place to be when booze stops working for you. I was a quart a night guy. I wasn't an alcoholic, because the alcoholic was the guy across the street from me. He drove his Olds Delta 88, basically poured his Olds Delta 88 into the driveway every night, stumbled into the house with a brown bag and beat the hell out of his wife. That wasn't me. I carried my bottle of Evan Williams into the house every night, my briefcase, thank you very much. I wasn't an alcoholic. And suddenly I was faced with the reality that I was an alcoholic, and it was like the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders. And I went to that first meeting, and wouldn't you know it, that first meeting was actually in my church. It was actually, it was interesting, because on Sunday I had a chat with a fellow one story up from where that meeting took place. And the funny thing is, now it's a ladies' restroom, it's a ladies' bathroom. They don't only have a meeting there. And mostly they have NA meetings there because they have a shelter for addicts. But they had a meeting for me that night. And The next day I went to a meeting at Triangle Club, and my wife describes it best. I married a girl in the program, and we've been married for 23 years. And she describes it like this. She said, when I was out drinking, I was a zebra running with the horses. And the problem was that the horses weren't interested in me, and I was a zebra. And she said, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found a room full of zebras. And I belonged. And I instantly belonged. I hooked into this thing, hook, line, and sinker, right away. And having read this book by Dr. Johnson, I checked myself into Beechwood Hospital and did about a three-week stint there. And when I was at Beechwood, my daughter turned two. And they wouldn't let me out of the hospital to go to her birthday party. They said, the best gift you can give that young lady is a sober dad. I said, okay. So anyway, I did get sober, and that first year, I know this to be true, and newcomers, I remember when I heard stuff like this, and I was like, but it's so true for me today that I know there's another drink left in me if I really want to take it. I'm not sure there's another recovery left in me, because the problem was I had to get sober that first year of sobriety, and I had a lot to get over. My sponsor, okay. God bless him. He's gone on to the big meeting in the sky, but he was my sponsor for 3 weeks shy of 20 years, And every year he gave me my birthday chip for 19 years. He gave me a birthday chip, and he introduced me as the angriest guy he ever met coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, O.K. had a habit of telling the truth, so I sort of believed him, you know. And I had a lot to get over, and I had a lot of wounds and shame and self-pity and denial. I instantly, the desire to drink was taken away from me almost immediately. But the desire to do other crazy, insane things did not. And of course, early in sobriety, I was chasing every skirt that moved and got very, very sick at that. And it came down to a Friday night at the meeting. I don't know what meeting they still have over here in the corner. They had a meeting over on Friday night, and Dick Hickey, some of y'all, I know Tim, I know you knew Dick. Some of y'all knew Dick. Basically, if I told him if he didn't hear my fourth step, because my sponsor was supposed to be in town that weekend to do my fourth and fifth step. That's about 6 months sober. And I told Dick if he did weren't going to be there, I think I might drink. Or maybe I didn't tell him that, but he could tell it. And so we ended up going over to his apartment on Lenox Road up until about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I just poured all this stuff out. And the next day, I came back over here. I slept in, but I came over here. It was a beautiful sunny day. And I can remember down where the smoking pavilion thing is now. It used to just be down by the creek. It used to be this creek down there. And I remember just, you heard the term lighting the loafers. I was lighting my loafers. I mean, I was walking about this high off the ground. I felt so different, so changed. And I had become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, things got better and better and better. So one of the interesting things that happened to me when I was in my last few weeks of drinking was, or at least happened around me, was that the city of Atlanta had made this little bid for this little party that they wanted to throw called the Olympic Games. And I remember one morning with a hangover, really bad hangover, hearing Juan Antonio Samaranch say, "It's Atlanta." And I remember the elation I think everybody else in Atlanta felt when that happened. But then I immediately went back into my depression because I knew that there was no way I could. I worked for a company that was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, the second biggest sponsor of the Olympics at the time. And it was a technology company. And I thought, well, you know, I could do this. But then I realized I couldn't do it because I was just, I mean, things had gotten so bad. The wheels were falling off. So a couple of years later, I get connected up with somebody who's actually already involved and asked me to help them with a project, which I did. And they invited me to come down to spend a little bit of time down at the Olympic Committee. And I said, okay. So I came down. Well, I tried to convince my boss to let me. And it turned out the boss grilled me on my evaluation that year because I didn't do anything for him. I was working for the company, but I was working on this other stuff. And I saw firsthand what a resentment can do and be. And boy, I remember to this day when he told me there was no way he was going to let me be involved. I wanted to go down to a meeting the very next day, Friday, we were going to talk about that meeting. And he said, "No, you're not going to be involved anymore." And I remember walking down the hall after he had said all this. I said, "Oh, whatever, God." Because I thought this would be really cool. And not 3 hours later, he called me back into his office. He said, "I want you to be in a meeting down at ATOG 3:30 Friday afternoon." And I was there. And so for the next 4.5 years, I worked on the Olympics. It was pretty darn cool. I was right in the middle of everything. What was really cool was when in June of 93, they sent a team of four of us from Atlanta to Lillehammer. So I was a member of the Lillehammer group of Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 or 9 months. And let me tell you something. If you've never been to a meeting, if you haven't been to a meeting out of town, get in your car and go to one. If you haven't been to a meeting out of state, get in your car and go to one. If you haven't been out of the country and gone to a meeting, let me tell you something. If you don't know by now that you're part of something really, really big, do that. Go to a meeting where you're the only person in the room who's a native English speaker. That's humbling. Believe me, it's humbling. The people I worked with were pretty impressed that I could that I had picked up so much Norwegian while I was there. I didn't tell them that I learned it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would let me share in English, and the rest of the meeting would be in Norwegian. Norwegians are very good English speakers. And so they would share, and I would begin to understand. There's a language, Bill Wilson called it the language of the heart. And I'll tell you a story about that. But this language transcends all the words that we use. You can walk into a meeting, and you can tell there's a guy sitting in the back corner, and he's in a bad way, and he needs you to help him. And he didn't say a word, and you didn't say a word, and all you got to do is sit down. And that's all it takes. And the magic starts to happen. Bill, in 1950, I believe it was, he and Lois decided to take a trip around. That was about the time that the traditions were being adopted. Bill and Lois decided to take a trip with AA around the world, besides just Canada and Mexico. And the first place that he went was Norway, because one of the guys in his group in New York had a brother who was bad to drink, and he sold everything he had, and he went to Norway to try to get his brother sober. His brother didn't get sober, but a bunch of the Norwegians did. And when I got there, they had a pretty good group flourishing in Lillehammer, and it was started by a woman named Marie. And this is really kind of interesting to me. Marie got sober in sort of, I'm not even sure where she got sober in Norway, but she had found that box 459 thing where we say, if there's, it says in here, if you're curious about alcoholism, write to us. She wrote to the General Service Office, and they connected her with a woman in South Africa, and the two of them got sober by writing letters to each other. We take it so much for granted that we can just run to a meeting. Oh, my head's curly. I gotta run to a meeting. They couldn't do that. They had one meeting a week, number Ort Everhøvdagen, at 7:30 on Monday nights, and it was amazing, truly amazing. And I actually have a friend on Facebook that we were friends when he wasn't in the program. He's not an alcoholic. It's kind of funny because he's always posting pictures of beers, and I smile and I send him a like, and you know, we have a good chuckle about it. He wishes me welcome in Norwegian, and I try to Google Translate back to him. But that was amazing. I spent my third anniversary in Lillehammer, Norway. So I got back. I did the whole Olympic thing, and let me tell you something. It was really, really hard. Really hard. There you got to imagine, it takes a couple of egos to throw a party and invite the world expecting to come. And there were a lot of egos in the Olympic Committee. And I clashed with more than my share of them. But, you know, it's funny. I could walk into a room of 100 people and find the one person that I'm going to have a fight with. And it doesn't take me very long to do that. I'm still recovering. I'm not the angriest man in Alcoholics Anonymous any longer. But I still have my moments. And as part of the deal, I spent 2 weeks in Japan. I spent a whole month in Japan. And Japan's a very alcoholic country, and it does not have very many meetings. And I only share that I went there because of the only meeting I got to the whole month I was in country. And by the way, I didn't get to many meetings, but I did have a $1,400 phone bill calling my sponsor from the company paid for it. Thank you very much. It was in their best interest. They really didn't want me getting drunk in Roppongi, Japan, you know, Tokyo. But my last day in country, I went to a meeting. It was in the Franciscan Center, the Catholic Center in Tokyo. And I sit down, and the person is an American that's leading the meeting, and they hand me how it works. I say, "Can you read how it works?" And I was like, "Sure, no problem." A woman comes in. I mean, she looks really shaky. And she sits down. She's an American, and she's got 7 days sober. And when I read how it works, I mean, I read how it works a lot in meetings and stuff. It's never like I remember it was that day, reaching out to this woman trying to get sober in a foreign country. Oh, my God. I cannot imagine that, because NABA was always here. Triangle was always here. I always had meetings. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, every day, for my first couple of years of sobriety. I have a lot to be grateful for. When it was all said and done, when the Olympics were done, I went out and put my knee on the ground at the athletes, after the closing ceremonies. I put my knee on the ground because I had access everywhere. I was actually in the TV control room 20 feet behind Don Mishner for the opening and closing ceremonies of the games. There was not a cooler place on the planet to be, and God did this. And I put the knee down, and I thank God. I thank God for the experience, and I thank God that it was over. And, you know, it was an amazing experience, and it was over 20 years ago. And I share it because there really is this spirit that transcends everything. We talk about the spirit of, one alcoholic with another. I hear the word spirit a lot, and I work a lot on my spirituality. And I remember a woman who was, my sport was short track speed skating. I worked on the results system for it. And there was a woman there from South Africa. Not only was she from South Africa, she was the entire South African Olympic team at that Olympics. It was the first time in 60 years that South Africa was allowed to be at the Olympic Games. And she was the entire team. She had no coaches, she had no trainers. You know, she had no big training facility. She was just there herself, from about as far away from Norway as you can get. And she was out there for every practice round, every trial, everything that she could. She was trying her all. She came in dead last in every heat, but she still did her best. She carried the spirit. And so, whenever I have to talk to people about my spirituality, I try to tell that story because people somehow get that when they don't get that God's kept me sober for almost 27 years. It's like, you know, oh really? Do you still have to go to those meetings? I firmly believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a power greater than myself. Now, a long time before that, not long after I did that thing with Dick Hickey, that little fourth and fifth step thing, I met a woman who was who lived near where I worked and worked near where I lived, and she had been transplanted from Chicago on 48 hours notice. And we met in the program, and we had a lot of common interests, animals. I mean, we just had this friendship. And it ended up, after she moved back to Chicago, we ended up having a 9-month long-distance relationship. And finally, we decided that we would get married. It actually took us a long time. We walked through that process. It took us 3 years before we actually got married. They say, Bill talks in the big book, on the 12 and 12, page 115, talks about boy meets girl on a campus. And he cautions us that, we tell a newcomer, we often tell it, but Bill never said it, don't date or make any important decisions the first year of sobriety. Well, the reason is because when you're in a relationship with somebody, you're either going to grow or you're going to go. And you're growing so fast already as a newcomer that it becomes really hard. But we grew together. And it really is kind of nice to have somebody. She's actually got more time than me. And it's nice to actually have somebody that is on a spiritual path, a spiritual way of life. I actually got to go to her home group last week because she was, because I was invited to come be the discussion leader at a meeting, and she ended up not feeling good and didn't come, so it was okay. And I'm allowed to go to her home group when she's out of town. So, but it's nice, we keep our programs separate, but we also grow in God together. And the neat thing about that whole business with my daughter getting sober and having a sober dad was, after the divorce, and I was ordered to pay child support for a long, long time. At the time, it was. Today it seems like it was nothing, but back then it was really a lot of money, a lot of money. And I kept up my child support payments until she was 18, when I didn't have to any longer. And then I helped put her through college. And there were times, the one thing I learned long, long ago was not to fight through my ex. And so I didn't. When she would push a button, and when I'm early in sobriety, I'm walking around with these huge buttons. And she would push them because she was a good Al-Anon. She never got Al-Anon, but she's had to walk her own spiritual road. We actually were good friends today. But I refused to fight through my daughter, basically, to put it that way. And I also made the conscious decision that no matter what, my daughter was a priority, and that at whatever time I was given to spend with her, I would. And then actually, as I started getting better, my ex started volunteering extra time that my daughter could spend with me, which was great. Until she turned to a teenager, and then she was more interested in doing other stuff than that, you know? And that was okay, too. And so the cool thing, what all that means is when Travis got married 2 years ago this month, actually 2 years ago, 2 weeks ago, her mother and I walked her down the aisle, and you know, basically gave my daughter away. My wife was there, one of the first people that my daughter turned to when after they were actually married was my wife. You know, we're an active part. She's got a great stepmom. My daughter has a wonderful stepmom. So anyway, through this whole business, I've had some amazing things happen in my life, which I am forever grateful, and I could talk for hours about all the cool stuff that God's done in my life. When I ever get to feeling lonely and afraid and I'm down in my cups, I think about some of the cool stuff that God has done in my life, or some of the wonderful people that God's put in my life. A lot of them aren't even here anymore, you know. They just aren't here anymore, and that saddens me, you know. And some folks go off the deep end, like Scout. And you know, there's things I don't understand in this world. But I'm very grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to share one last story, which is part and parcel of this whole deal. I worked for this big company. It turned out to, within a week, I worked for that company as much time sober as I was drunk. And when I had made the decision to leave, and before I actually realized that was after I had left that I realized that I had been there as long sober as I had been drunk, which means I had made my amends, and I was able to walk away sober and free. And I went with another company, I actually worked for the British Broadcasting Company for 3.5 years, which was phenomenal because I was an Anglophile from an early age in shortwave radio. I used to listen to the BBC on shortwave. And here I was working for them. Again, you know, and I was going to meetings. By the way, in London, they don't hug in meetings. But one of the best meetings that I've ever been to in Alcoholics Anonymous is less than a block away from Buckingham Palace. If they only knew. You know, it's at St. Peter's Church. It was just literally around the corner from Buckingham Palace. But darn those lineys, they don't hug in the meetings, which I really miss whenever I'm there, but I love them to death. And I don't even know where I was going with that. Anyway, so I ended up, for the past 10 years, I was working for another major corporation. And one of the things I realized in that period of time was I was not fit for working in corporations. I've worked in corporations for now for 40 years. Or involved in corporations, either corporate through study at Georgia Tech or working for major corporations. And I just don't fit the corporate mold well. I didn't work well in a three-piece suit. I don't like wearing a tie. We were talking about that before, Michael. And so anyway, things were getting really rough in my company. There had been a corporate acquisition. The big company bought, the bigger company bought a big company, and as a result, you know, there was a lot of friction in my business unit, and I was feeling it, and everybody was feeling it, and most everybody was running around in fear, and I'm like, guys, chill out. And I would be on these conference calls a year ago, and I can remember to this day, I would be wanting to bite my boss's head off for something nasty he had said to me, and I would put the phone on mute, and I would say the serenity prayer, and I still had a job. And a year ago in June, I walked a part, as some of you have heard of the Camino de Santiago. It's a pilgrimage walk. And I was, all this time I'm walking this road, a lot of time to myself, prayer, meditation. It's a very spiritual thing to do. And I kept waiting for this big booming voice out of the sky to come tell me what to do. And the only thing I ever really came to realize was trust God. Trust God, trust God. And it was funny because the day before my 26th anniversary, my boss called me into his office to tell me that they had gotten rid of my job. Well, and actually turned out they had gotten rid of, within 2 months they got rid of the whole department. But instead of walking away with nothing, which would have happened if I had told my boss what I was thinking about him, I walked away with a nice severance. I walked away with a decent retirement settlement. And I was able to start my own business. And it's something I've wanted to do for a long, long time. I'll tell you what, I got an idiot for a boss. But that's okay, too, because at least he's going about it prayerfully. I'm doing my best. I constantly talk with my higher power. And I'm like, I need to be making a little money right now. But that's okay, too. You know, I'm in development, and I'm trying to make it work. And I'm trying to say that, you know, you can follow your heart and that the rest will follow. And I'm banking on that. I'm trusting on that. And it's still, I mean, it's not, you know, I hedge my bets with God just like everybody else does. But I think I'm getting better. And I know I'm getting better when I care about people like Scout, who I know was just alone and afraid and tied up in whatever form of mental illness he had that caused him to want to have the cops shooting. And that's what he said, by the way, shoot me. And there was a time when I would have rather you shot me. You know, I didn't want to commit suicide because I wanted to stick around and make life miserable for you. But deep down inside, I really didn't want to wake up the next morning and it still be alive. I mean, there were times when I really wish I hadn't. And my God, there's a fellow named Keith Lewis always used to say, you know, if you kill yourself within the first 5 years of the program, you're killing the wrong man. You know, because we change so much. I've come to realize you're always killing the wrong man, because one of the good things about this program is one of my favorite quotes, and I'll close with this, it's Michelangelo. Michelangelo said, I am still learning. And I am still learning. The minute I stop learning, the minute I stop growing, I think I start dying. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you all tonight.
Thank you so much for that, Mike. I do feel like we know you.
When it's dying time, color gone from the trees. Like a fire that once burned hot, dropping fast now by degrees. It's the strangest feeling when I'm coming after me. Since you went away, everything feels broke. I need somebody to take me in from the cold. feel like crying, crying out your name. Feel like trying hard, trying to relight the flame. Somebody to take